Okay, so first I just want to make a follow-up comment that we discussed this briefly when we finished last week. Ariel had brought it up, so I just wanted to quickly pick up one point from next week and then move on to the next topic. Ariel had asked what happens to Rivka, right? We talked about, right, it was Yaakov wrong, was Yaakov not wrong, was he punished, was he not punished, and what was happening in the ensuing stories. But we did, you know, sort of leave out Rivka. So Ariel asked afterwards what we say about Rivka. So I said at the time, and I still think that this is probably, at some level correct, that if you think that Yaakov and Rivka were wrong, then you do see that Rivka is punished, because if you think about the story, Yaakov and Rivka, deceive Yitzchak in order to ensure that Yaakov will be the one to carry on the legacy of Yitzchak. And yet, right, the next thing that happens is, in order to save Yaakov, she has to send Yaakov away. And then she dies before he comes back. So I said, I think a very simple way of reading that story is that if Rivka was wrong and she deceitfully had helped Yaakov get the legacy of Yitzchak in a way he shouldn't have, then the fitting punishment at some level would be that she doesn't get to see the fruition of it. Because even if it's true that Yaakov is supposed to have that legacy, if it was done the wrong way, so her punishment is it happens, but she doesn't actually get to reap the benefits. I still think that's probably true, but when I looked around to see if anyone said anything differently, and I found that Ray Foreman suggested, and I'm not totally convinced of it, but we can look at it, is maybe Rivka didn't actually plan the deceit, right? A new possibility. Maybe she didn't. She wasn't actually involved in the deceit. And he suggests this based on a close reading of the Psukim. So you just turn quickly to the story leading up to it. Get to it. Yeah. Right. The beginning of Perek Chav Zayin. Right, so we have Vayiki Zaken Yitzchak, Vatechen Einav Meraot, Vayikrat Esav Beno Agadol, Vayomer Lav Bini, Vayomer Lav Hineini. Right, Yitzchak is getting old and his eyes are dimming, and he calls to Esav, and he says, "My son," and he says, "Here I am, Vayomer Nezakanti, Lo Yadati Yomoti," right, "I've gotten old and I don't know when I'm going to die," etc. And then in Pasur Kei, Virufka Shomad Bidaber Yitzchak Al Esav Beno, Vayelach Esav Asadela Tzayed Lahavi. And Rivka hears, and then she sees that Esav goes out to hunt. So, and now, Ray Foreman, you know, suggests that we read the Psukim very carefully and see whether Rivka actually was ever part of the deceit. So if you read it, Virivka Amral Yaakov Bina. So Rivka says to her son, Leimor, saying, "Hinei shamati et avicha medaber al Esav achicha Leimor. I heard your brother speaking to your father speaking to your brother, rather. Havi alitzayid vasei matamim ve'ochila. So bring me food, and I'll make it into good food, and he'll eat. Vavarechecha lifnei Hashem lifnei moti. Sorry, I heard Yitzchak saying, rather, that to Esav, go make food so I can bless you. Vata b'ni shma v'koli, and now listen to my voice. V'ashar ni mitzavotach, that which I'll tell you. Lechna elatzon v'kachli misham shnei g'deyei zim tovim v'aseh otam matamim l'avicha kasher ahev, and I'll make you food for your father. V'evita l'avicha v'achal b'avur asher yivarechecha lifnei moto, and you'll bring it to your father so that he blesses you before he dies. And he notes that if you look at Rivka's plan, right, there isn't actually any deceit in it. She just says, "Look, I overheard this. You know, why don't you push your way in, right, and bring food and say, you know what, you're making a mistake. Why don't you just," right, he suggests, maybe what Rivka's saying is, "Why don't you just tell your father he's making a mistake, right? Like, go bring the food in and have an open confrontation with him." Vayomer Rivka Yaakov Rivkaimo. Now, right, people think, right, from the next pasuk, and I still think this is probably true, that Rivka did intend to see, because it says, "Vayomer Yaakov Rivka imo, heini savachi ish sa'ir, my brother is hairy, vanochi ish halak, and I'm smooth, ulai musheni aviva yita ve'inav k'mat mitateh, he'll feel me, and he'll think that I'm mocking, ve'viti alaikla lo v'lo bracha, and I'll get cursed and not blessed, v'tomer lo imo alaikla atcha b'ni, I'll take the curse for you, achshma b'koli v'leich kachli, but go and get the food and bring it to your father." So I tend to think, and I think this is the way almost everyone understands it, that it's clear that Rivka was part of the deceit. Because even though she didn't say, "Go deceive," right, Yaakov's response is, "But he's going to feel me and he's going to realize that I'm Esav." And she says, "Okay, if that happens and he curses you, I'll take the curse." So it sounds Like that's the case. But Reformant suggests that maybe that's not the case. Again, I say this is very tentatively, and I'm not convinced by it, but it could be. That maybe what she's saying is go confront him. And he suggests that the backstory to this, is, as we've talked about a little bit last week, is that Yitzchak wants whoever leads to be someone with initiative, right? A doer, right? And at some level, maybe the reason he preferred Esav was because he saw Yaakov as passive and not able to start a nation and, right, to defend their stay in the land. And Esav is the doer and is the hunter and can build an army. And Yaakov can't, so he needs Esav. So he suggests that maybe what Rivka is saying, go confront him. Right, show that you can, right, stand up for yourself. And what Yaakov responds is, but he's going to realize I'm not Esav, right? Like he's going to, he'll feel my hand and remember that I'm just, that's not who I am, right? I can, go and be forceful and stand up for myself, but I'm still not Esav. And therefore he's going to curse me for trying. And Rivka says, I'll take the curse. So this is what Reformant suggests. I'm not convinced. I still think that it's more likely what I said before, that Rivka is punished according to this line of reasoning, right? That she was part of the deception. And either you think the deception was fine, in which case she isn't punished, or it wasn't fine and she's punished because she never gets to Yaakov, but this is just another possibility. Again, I'm not sure it's compelling, but just to throw it out there. Okay, which brings us to this week. And what I want to do, the source sheet looks very different than most source sheets. What I want to do is I want just to analyze, right, the question we'd opened up last week with the bracha story is, right, depending on how you understand the story will affect what happens to Yaakov afterwards. So the question I want to ask is, well, what happens to Yaakov afterwards? And how do we understand everything that happens and how does it flow from the bracha story? Okay, so what you notice from the bracha story for the next 200 psukim or so, which is the aftermath story of the bracha, right, is his journey to Lavan, and then the end is him coming back, right? So the whole next unit, which is him leaving, everything in between and coming back, is that it creates a huge 200 pasuk chiasm. Now, right, chiastic structures, right, which is basically the X, Y, X structure, right, or the ABCBA structure, right, where, right, you have elements at each side of the story that parallel coming to something in the middle. You find them a lot in Tanakh, and when you do, the function of a chiasm, right, what's the function literally of a chiasm, right? It just comes from the Greek, right, the key, which is the X, right? Right, is that, what does it do, right, literally? It leads you to the center. Right, when you find a chiastic structure, what it does is it says, well, here's a unit, right? And something in the middle teaches you about the nature of the entire story. And from the bracha story, through his coming back, right? So from his fleeing to his return to Israel, you find a chiasm. And I think by analyzing the chiasm, first you'll figure out what's in the middle, right? And therefore the message of the story. But the second thing is that some chiasms have actual parallels in the A, the AA structure. But sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have similarities, but there's been development. Right? Like, you'll find similar elements, but something has changed from A to A prime, and something's changed from B to B prime. And in addition to learning about the purpose of the story from the middle of the chiasm, you'll learn something about the story based on the changes that happen from A to A prime, and B to B prime, and C to C prime, etc. So what I want to do is really just analyze the next 200 psukim, right, basically, and try to figure out what is the center of the story, right, or the centers of the story. We're not going to get into exactly the middle, but we'll see what it leads to, and also try to figure out what develops from all the A, B, C, to the A, B, C primes, right, to the second half of the chiasm, right? So I try to illustrate it. I think it's relatively clear, right? But this is the chiasm that goes to the next 200 psukim, right? So just to show the opening of it, right? So if we start with the bracha story, right? In the middle of the bracha story, we have this, Yitzchak asks Yaakov for his name. He lies about his name, but he asks him for his name, and he blesses him, right? So this is in Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk, Pasuk Chav Dalet. Vayomer Atazeh Bini Esav. Vayomer Ani. Are you Esav, my son? Vayomer Hagish Alev Eochleu. And he said, come and eat, etc. He asks his name, and this leads to it in Pasuk Chav Zayin. Vayivarcheyu, and he blesses him. Right. So that's right. The bracha story. If you look all the way at the other side of the chiasm, and this is the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. Vayishlach. Right, so 200 psukim or so later. Originally, when I tried to draw the chiasm, I tried to include the parallel psukim, but then I realized that you wouldn't see it because it would be too long, and I couldn't get it in one page. So you look at Perek Lamed Bet, right? Pasuk Chav Bet. This is the battle with the angelic figure. Vayivater Yaakov levado ve'avek ishimo ad halod hashachar. So Yaakov is left alone, and he wrestles until morning with this person. Vayar kilo yacholo, and he saw that he couldn't beat him. Vayigav v'kafi yarecho. So this angelic person hit him in his thigh. Vateka kafregel Yaakov be'avko imo, and he got injured. Vayomer shalcheni kela hashachar. Now this angel says, "Send me because it's morning." Vayomer lo hashalecha chakim berachtani. Says, "I won't send you away unless you give me a bracha." Vayomer elav. So he says, "Mashim echa, what's your name?" Vayomer Yaakov. Vayomer lo Yaakov yamer od shimcha, you will no longer be called Yaakov, ki im Israel, ki sarita im Elokim v'iman Hashem v'atuchal. Because you have conquered gods, right, or whatever, angelic creatures, and people, and you have succeeded. So you have at this side, you have Yaakov again being asked for his name, and in fact, renaming him and giving him a bracha. But it's more than that, right? Because if you look at the next unit in the bracha story, right, Yaakov lies about his name. And then Esav comes in, and Esav says, right, after he's told that he stole your bracha, so he says, in Pasuk Lamed Vav, right, he's going to have to keep switching back and forth here, Vayomer, he says, Achi kara shemo Yaakov, is this why you called him Yaakov? Ve'yakveni zef amayim. He tricked me twice. Ebechorati lakach, v'nei ata lakach birchati. And now he's taken my bracha. So it's not just that you have this asking of the name, right? What is Esav doing when he says, is this why you called him Yaakov? Right? What's the force of him saying that? He's not naming Yaakov, but what is he doing? He's interpreting Yaakov's name to mean that what? How does Yaakov always succeed? By Akveni Zef Amayim, through deceit. The Malach naming him story is in fact, right, what does he tell him? Right, it's not just that he gives him a name, but he actually explains how Yaakov is successful. Why does he, right, he says, I'm calling you Yisrael, ki sarita em Elokim ven Hashem v'atuchal. Right, both times you have a someone asserting, isn't this his name because... Right, Esav says, aren't you Yaakov because you are deceitful? And that's the only way you're victorious over your enemies. And you have the Malach saying, you are Yisrael because you are victorious over your enemies. But now if we start asking difference between A and A prime, is in both times you have a naming story, so to speak, and you have an interpretation of the name having to do with their ability to be victorious, but the difference is, right, he's... Ve'akveni zefamayim, does it in deceit? And what type of battle is the Malach talking about? An open battle, right? It was raw physical strength. He is wrestling with him, right? And he beats him. In the open, nothing is secret, right? So now if you look, right, to the first two elements, right, you have these naming stories, and you have this description of the name that relate to how Yaakov is victorious, but the difference between A and A prime is that he goes from being Yaakov, which is explained as him being victorious through deception, to being Yisrael, who's victorious without deception. Right? So if we look at the outskirts, it already sounds like the chiasm is going to lead us to some, right, fundamental message about Yaakov, because, right, we just said that the question you have to ask after the brachot story is, right, was Yaakov deceptive? right? Was he punished for it? And if not, then what happened? And then why does he have to flee to Lavan? So we see already, right, that one possibility is going to be that if you think he made a mistake in being deceitful, then something happens in the middle that teaches him to not be deceitful, and that's the difference between A and A prime. But now let's continue this chiasm. So now if you continue here, right, so after Esav in the bracha story finds out that Yaakov has stolen his bracha, the next element, Yitzchak says, I've already made him a master over you. So in Pasuk Lamed Chet, Vayisa Esav Kolo Vayeich. Esav lifts up his voice, Vayisa, and he cries. Right? And if you go to the beginning of Vayishlach, Yaakov says when he, right, this was the last time he'd seen Esav, and now he's about to see Esav again. So he sends people there. Now when he meets, second. Where's the pasuk? Ulai Isafanecha. Yeah, here. It is in pasuk. Pasuk Chof Aleph, right? Right before he meets Esav, it describes how Yaakov wants to meet Esav, right? So he's sent all the gifts, and he's sent the messages, and he's divided up the camp. But why did he send the gifts? So in Pasuk Chof Aleph, in Perek Lamed Bet, he says, Vamartem, Gam Hine Avdecha Yaakov. Tell him. Don't just bring the gift. Say, your servant Yaakov is coming acharenu, after us. Ki amarach barav hanav vamincha olech elefanai. Because maybe he'll atone for what he's done with his gift. And then I'll see his face. Ulai yisafanai. Maybe he will, right? Forgive me, but the language is yisafanai, which is vayisa Esav kalo vayev, right? It's his goal is that before Esav was vayisa kolo vayev, Esav was lifted up in tears, and now he says, I want to make it better because I want him to be no se kapa. I want him to forgive me, but it uses the same language. I want him to forgive me, right? So you see this, right? This linguistic parallels on the two parts of the chiasm. And then if you continue, right, you have, right, after Yaakov steals the bracha and Esav cries, so then Esav threatens that he's going to kill Yaakov, but he doesn't just say he's going to kill Yaakov. He says, when is he going to kill Yaakov? Right, pasuk mem aleph. Vayistom Esav et Yaakov al habracha asher barachoh aviv. Right, and listen to the word that keeps getting emphasized here. He was angry at him for the bracha that he stole from his father. Vayomer Esav bilibo. So Esav said in his heart, Yikravu yimei evil avi. The days of mourning will come from my father. Vargad Yaakov achi, and I'll kill Yaakov, my brother. So he will kill Yaakov when specifically, right, after his father dies, meaning he's not willing to kill Yaakov until his father dies. Rivka doesn't realize that Esav won't kill him until Yitzchak dies, and she says what? That she tells him to flee. Why? Because what might happen, right, in Pasuk Memhei, Lama Eshkal Gam Shneichem Yom Echad, because why should I as a mother lose both my children in one day? Right? So you have two elements here. You have Esav saying he won't kill Yaakov when his father's alive, but Rivka being worried that her sons will be killed in her presence. And now if you go to the story of Yaakov meeting Esav, he's one of the reasons that he needs to appease Esav. So this is in Pasuk Yud Bet, right? Again, we're just going backwards here. Atzileni na miyad achi miyad Esav. Right? He davens to God, save me from Esav. Ki arei anochi oto pen yavo v'yikani aim al banim, because he might kill parents with children. But that's playing on the last unit in the story where Esav said he wouldn't kill parents with children, but Rivka was afraid that aim al banim, right? That as a mother, she would lose both of her children, right, in the same day, right? So it's not just that, right? So at one end of it, you have Esav threatening to kill Yaakov, but not while his father's alive, but Rivka being worried that it will be while she's alive. And the other end, you have Yaakov worrying that Esav will kill parents and children, right? That he will see the loss, right? So you have these parallels, right? And then you have, right, if we continue after we get out of the bracha story, so now he runs away, but he runs away at, right, he doesn't just run away. Before he has to run away, what has to happen? Right, Rivka says go away, but he doesn't leave until what? Right, Rivka convinces Yitzchak to tell him to go, meaning until he's commanded. Right, he's commanded to leave. Right, so he's commanded to run away from Esav. Right, and then right, what's the beginning of Parshat Vayishlach? Right, so if we're following it, right, there's a command to run away from Esav, and Vayishlach starts with a Yaakov commanding, right, commanding the Malachim to go to Esav. Right, so in both times you have a command, right, with relation to Esav, but in one direction you have go away from Esav, and then the beginning of Vayishlach is you have a command to go to Esav, but now who are the commanders, right, if we want to do, right, the A and A prime here, right, Yaakov was the object on the first side of the chiasm. He's A, the object, and B, he's running away. And now in the second half of the chiasm, he is running to, and he's the commander. Right? So you already see, right, a parallel, but you see a difference. When Yaakov runs away, he runs away, and he meets the place, which the Pasuk says, Vayifga b'makom. Right now, the language is very clear. You look at just the first pasuk in Vayetze Yaakov Mirsheva Yilech Harana. So Yaakov, this is the beginning of Vayetze. Vayetze, right, he starts with Vayifka b'makom, right, he meets the place. And if you go to the end of Parshas Vayetze, right, when he finally leaves Lavan, right, after his encounter with Lavan, so the last two psukim here of Vayetze is Vayakov halach ledarko, Yaakov leaves, Vayifgu bo malachei Elohim. This time again you have a pigia, but this time it's not Yaakov hitting a place, it's the angels being pogeya in him. Now, remember that in the first story, it wasn't just Vayifgu bo makom, what was his vision? Malachim, right? He saw at the beginning of Vayetze, he goes to sleep in that place and he dreamt, and behold, right? Malachei Elokim Olim Biordim Bo. There are Malachim going up and down. So the end of the story, again, he has Vayifgu Malachei Elokim. He has a pigiyah, he has a meeting, and again, with angels. But, right, so that's the parallel, but what's the difference, right? The difference between them is, again, in the beginning of Vayetze, he is, right, Vayifga b'makom, and he sees the angels. But how does he see the angels? Right, what state is he in? He's asleep. It's a dream, and he sees them going up and down. When he's Vayifga b'makom, Vayifgu bo malachei Elokim at the end of Vayetze. Right, what happens? As we already said, is he passive? No, he's awake. Right, he meets them head on, and not only that, but he then commands them, right? So we have a meeting, we have a pigiyah with Malachim, but in the first half of the chiasm, he's passively meeting them, and he's sleeping. In the end of the chiasm, he meets them, but he's awake, he's the commander. And again, he names both places. At the beginning of Vayetze, right, he calls the place Beit Elokim. At the end of Parshat Vayetze, he calls it, right, Machane Elokim, right? Both of them are, right, places of God, right? And he has this naming process in both of them where he recognizes that God is there. But again, in one of them, he is passively engaged, and one of them, he is actively, right? And we'll do one more before we get to the... a few more, and then we'll get to the center of the story, right? Beginning of Parshat Vayetze. Yaakov, when he's in Beit El, right? He has the dream, and he has a conversation with God. And he says that if you save me, so then, right, the last pasuk in, this is the last pasuk in Perek Chav Chet, he said, Va'even azod asher samti matseva, this stone which I've put, yeh beit Elokim, will be a place of God, v'kol asher titin li aser asrenu lach, and everything that I have, I'll give you 10%. So we have Yaakov doing two things, which is setting up a rock, a matseva, and promising 10%. Of his wealth to God. At the end of Parshat Vayetze, right? Laban has chased after him, and after not finding any of his stolen goods, so they make a pact. Why did they make a pact again, right? Laban didn't want to make a pact, but he did make a pact because Hashem had told him, don't touch Yaakov. So this is the fulfillment of that, right? Yaakov had said, I'm making a matzeva and promising 10% of my wealth to God so that he'll protect me. And at the end of the story, you have Laban can't hurt him because God is protecting him. Right? And the language he uses when Yaakov explains how God protects him in Pasuk Mem Aleph is Zeli Esrim Shana Veitecha Vaticha Arbasre Shana Bishne Venotecha Shtevanim Bitsonecha. For 20 years I worked for you, right? 14 for your daughters and 6 for your animals. Vatachlevit Maskurti, and you switched my salary, Aseret Monim, 10 times, right? 10, right? That magic number. There was something about magic, right? That magic number 10. And now, Lule Elohe Avi Elohe Avram, Ufachad Yitzchak Hayali, and you would have succeeded if God hadn't protected me. Right? So you have a monetary 10, right, with God protecting. But before it's Yaakov davening that he should be protected, right? And now it's Yaakov saying, I was protected 10 times, right? And the manifestation of that is, right, so Laban, realizing he can't win, right, instead makes a covenant with Yaakov. And what do they do to seal the covenant? Vayasu, right, this pasuk mem vav, vayasu, gal. They make what's a gal? A stone, right, monument, which is exactly what we had before, right? He made a stone monument to daven to God to be protected. And now that God has protected him, right, we set up a stone monument, right? Now, the middle of Vayetze is his 20 years at Lavan's house. And if you just look here, now we're towards the center, right? We have a bunch of things in the middle, right? The first thing that happens to him when he gets to Lavan's house is Lavan tricks him and switches his wives, right? We have two parallels at the end of the story, right? One is that Yaakov's wives switch themselves, right? Which we discussed in the first week, but you know, a while ago, but this story we all know, that Yaakov's wives switched themselves, right, in the Dudaim trade, right? And we have another trickery of Laban, where Laban tries to trick Yaakov with his salary, but instead of succeeding this time, he doesn't, right? So we have, right here, actually, a double, right, a chiasm with two branches, right, that we have Yaakov being tricked by Laban successfully, and that branches off into Yaakov's wives switching themselves, right, successfully doing, but it's in the open, right, there's no trickery, right, there's a switching of wives with no trickery, and you have Laban trying to trick Yaakov with regard to his salary and failing, right, and then in the middle of this whole story, right, you have all the stories of the sisters and the birth of the Shvatim, and there's a lot, obviously, in there that relates to the characters in there, right, you know, Ray Forman, I saw a few people who point out this chiasm. Ray Forman tries to focus on the part of the chiasm that focuses on Rachel and Leah, which is inside all the way in the middle of this chiasm. But I want to focus on the outside of the chiasm, right? At this point, right, we've seen that the story seems to be very much leading us back to this time in Lavan's house and making the point clear that something happened between A and A prime, right, in Lavan's house, right, that explains the story. Or if we want to draw it sharper, right, the end of the chiasm is Yaakov being called Yisrael, right? Meaning the formation of the Jewish people can't happen until whatever it is that happens in this middle happens, right? He is blessed with the bracha in the end of the bracha story, but he can't actually take the role as the bearer of the legacy until the end of this chiasm. And what I think becomes clear when you follow the chiasm is that something in the middle of this story explains what it is that has to happen to Yaakov for him to become Yisrael, right? To him to be able to become the father of the Jewish people. The question now becomes, right, once we've traced it, is, well, what happened in the middle, right? What is it that Yaakov has to gain to become Yisrael? Okay? So, and here, right, we have to come back to what we said last week. Right, so last week we said, right, that there are different ways of understanding the stealing of the bracha. Right, either we say that really they were wrong. Right? They were wrong. And if they were wrong, then there needs to be punishment. Right? So something in the story, right, is going to, right, presumably, right, I'll make it sharper. There's punishment. But if there's punishment, that means that Yaakov is doing something wrong. If Yaakov is doing something wrong, presumably something has to happen before he can become Yisrael, which is not just that he's punished, but that he learns his lesson, right? If there's a problem and Yaakov gets to be the father of the Jewish people, then presumably what we're looking for is him learning the lesson, not just being punished, but learning the lesson. Now, if we think that he didn't do anything wrong, then we still have to ask, right? It makes the question even sharper than why did he have to go through this? Right? There's either way, whether you think he did something wrong or he didn't do something wrong, it's clear that, right, he doesn't actually get to bring the bracha to fruition until whatever happens in the middle. So, right? So now the question that we have is to figure out, well, right, what is it in the middle, right, for each of these possibilities? So let's take any of them, right? Let's take the assumption first that Yaakov did nothing wrong. Right, let's start with the classic assumption that we started with last week, that Yaakov did nothing wrong. He was supposed to steal the bracha from Yitzchak, right? And that was the right thing to do, and he did it in the right way. Okay? So the question that maybe we didn't flesh out quite enough last week, but now we'll try a little bit, is why? Right? Why, if you assume Yaakov did nothing wrong, that means God wanted it not just that he would get the bracha, but he would do it through deception. But why, right? Why did he have to do it through deception? Right? That just begs the question. And so we started talking about it last week, right? That what we know about Yaakov and Esav until that point is what? That Esav is the doer, right? And that might be necessary. And Yaakov is Ish Tam Yoshev Alim, right? He's the simpleton. He's the pure one, right? He's naive. He's sheltered. So I think the simplest explanation would be to say that if Yaakov had to deceive Yitzchak, and that was the right thing to do, that was because the one thing that was missing in Yaakov was his ability to get his hands dirty, and, right, because being a leader isn't always, you know, clean, right? You can't just be the Ish Tam Yoshev Olim, right? Sometimes you have to do things that are, you know, first of all, you have to be a doer, but not just you have to be a doer. You have to be ready to do things which are, you know, things are morally ambiguous. You need to be able to take a stand even in difficult situations. You need to be able to deal with deception. So I would say the simplest understanding is that at some level, Hashem wanted Yaakov to transform from the Ish Tam Yoshev Olim, right, the naive person, and wanted to sort of throw him into the real world and say, if you want to be a leader, you have to learn how to deal with the world. Now, if that's true, then let's look at the chiasm, and let's see if the chiasm can be read to support the theory that what has to happen between the bracha story and Yaakov becoming Yisrael is that he has to transform from a passive person into a doer who can deal with the complexity of the real world. So if we look at our chiasm chart, right? So let's look at it, right? So first we have Yitzchak asking Yaakov for his name, fine, and giving him bracha. And then we have the Malach renaming him. So that we've already explained, right? That the journey here is from Yaakov to Yisrael. But now, right, let's say that this is the beginning of Yaakov learning how to deal with the world. So being deceptive, right? How much of a doer do you have to be deceptive? Right? And he's you know, his mother is telling him to go and deceive his blind father. I mean, he's starting to stand up for himself in sort of a weird, backhanded way, a little bit questionable, but okay, but that's the only way he can be victorious. Now, who's the Yaakov we see at the end of the chiasm? The Yaakov who is Kisarita Emelo, right, Madam Velokim Vetuchal. You openly fought and you won. Right? So there is a transformation from him being the only way he can be victorious is, you know, if no one realizes he's there, and pretending to be someone else to being, no, this is who I am. Kisarita im Elokim, right, Vaadam. Now, if we skip the I mean, we can look at all of them, right? Esav raises his voice and cries, and here he's, right, in response to what Yaakov does, and here Yaakov is initiating, right, in trying to fix that, but, right, you know, that's not as clear. But the, right, the next ones definitely are, right? Esav threatens to kill Yaakov, so Yaakov's response at the beginning of the chiasm is to run away. His response at the other end of the chiasm is to confront him, is to send the malachim, which brings us to the malachim. At the beginning of the chiasm, he's an object. He's lying there sleeping. He's been commanded and been sent away and seen passively, the angels going up and down. The other side, you see him as a commander of an army of angels, right, and of his family, and he's, right, he's no longer seeing them in a dream, he's commanding them, and he's not running away from Esav, he's confronting Esav. Right, in the rock story number one, Yaakov is setting up rocks, right, so that God will protect him. In the other side, Yaakov is, right, taking his protection as a given and using it to forge a treaty. Right, he's no longer, right, saying, please help me. He's saying, you have helped me. Now, right, I'm strong enough to make a treaty because, right, I have the confidence that you have, right, protected me. Right, in the wife switching story, right, Yaakov is successfully tricked by Lavan at the beginning of the story, but by the end, right, Yaakov tricks Lavan to get out. Right, he knows how to trick the trickster and runs away. And in fact, that's what Lavan says to him, is, why did you trick me? Why did you leave? And he says, what do you mean? You tricked me, so I got out. I tricked my way out. I ran away, right? I left. I deceived you, and I left. Right, and even the Dudaim story, right, you have a wife switch story again, but again, here with the wives, they were just as passive in the first switching story, right, as Yaakov was. In the second one, they're not, right? Rachel and Leah actively switch. They make a trade, the Dudaim, for a night with Yaakov, right? So I think one way of reading the story, right, is if you think that Yaakov did nothing wrong, there was still something that was missing in his character. And I think what that was is that in order for him to be a leader, he had to become a doer, and he had to be able to deal with difficult situations, both, you know, dangerous situations and morally questionable situations, and conquer them. And that's in fact what you see. The difference between all the first half of the chiasms and the second half of the chiasm is that Yaakov faces the same situations, but this time he's not passive, he's active, and this is what, right, he's not being sent, he's sending. He's not being deceived, right, he's deceiving the deceiver, right, and you see, so if nothing else, someone emerging as, right, as a, right, someone hardened by experience. So I think if we think that Yaakov did nothing wrong, then the lesson of the chiasm is simply that even though he did nothing wrong, right, he couldn't become Yisrael until he learned how until he learned from the experience of life to become a doer, right? To be able to deal with everything that he encountered. So that, I think, is one way of reading the story, okay? But let's say, right, that Yaakov did in fact sin. So we're going to expect a few things, right? First, we already talked last week about the fact that we're going to expect punishment. And we saw punishment, right? We saw that he deceived, he got deceived, including the, right, the harsh line of, we don't switch the older for the younger here. Maybe you do, right? But, right, it's not going to be enough just to see him be punished, right? What we're looking for is that he somehow learned a lesson. Right, if we look at this story, right, we can easily read this story that way as well. But to fully understand, I think we have to take an interesting step back. And this was a point that one of my friends made, David Block. I think it's a very good point. He takes it in a little bit of a different direction, but I think it's a very good point. Is that until Yaakov, right? No, this understanding will really border on being a punishment and lesson, and being, you know, making and you know, making Yaakov into who he is without punishment. But it's the same either way. He said, until Yaakov, we have the stories of all the Avot are the chosen ones. Starting at Yaakov, we begin a series of stories of people who are not the chosen one becoming the chosen one. Or even not becoming the chosen one, but being part of the chosen people. So we've already seen that Yaakov is like that. Right? Yaakov is not the chosen one by Yitzchak. Right? Or at least plausibly not the chosen one by Yitzchak. And therefore, he has to learn how to deal with not being the chosen one. Right? In the beginning of the chiasm, how does he deal with it? He deals with it through deception. At the end, he deals with it by trying to make it up to Esav. Right? So hold that. But then we have a bunch of them in the middle as well, right? We have, in the middle of the chiasm, we have Rachel and Leah, who both go through non-chosen moments, right? Leah is the non-chosen one, right, who ends up marrying Yaakov, but because she wasn't supposed to be there, she becomes the Isha Snua, right? She's the one who's less loved, and the whole story is about Leah dealing with that reality that she's not the chosen wife. And Rachel, even though she is the chosen wife, right, gets tricked out of marrying Yaakov by her father. And even when she marries Yaakov, she doesn't have children, right? So she ends up being shunted to the side, right, not through no fault of Yaakov, but she has that feeling of not being, right, part of the legacy. The stories that follow this, right, are the same thing happening within Yaakov's family, right? The Yosef story is all about that, right, right, Reuven, who's the Bechor, should be chosen, becomes the not chosen one. Yosef is the chosen one and gets sent away and has to go through a period of being the slaves. All the other brothers are dealing with the fact that they're not the chosen ones, right? And they start by dealing with Yosef badly and then eventually make up with Yosef, right? So starting with Yaakov going through his sons, you have a series of stories of people who are, right, the not chosen ones and somehow have to grapple with their lack of chosenness. Even if they end up getting chosen, right? They have to go through the experience of not being chosen. Which leads us to the question of, well, why, right? Why does everyone have to go through a non-chosenness, right, experience? So I would suggest that it could be, right, to give a mashal, the Ramban, right, in several places, says that the Bnei Yisrael had to go through Mitzrayim, right? Because, as we see later on in the Torah, right, many of the mitzvot are based on the fact that, remember, you were slaves in Mitzrayim. So Ramban argues we had to go to Mitzrayim because in order to have sympathy and have empathy for people who are in an unfortunate situation, you have to have experienced being in an unfortunate situation, right? So we go through the Kor HaBarzel, we go through the, right, the melting furnace, right? In order to become the people we want to be, right, to become the ethical people that we're supposed to be, we need to have the experience of being the unfortunate ones, right? We remember that we were Gerim, we were slaves, so we'll have sympathy for, right, the unfortunate ones afterwards. At some level, that may be what's happening here with Yaakov, right? Yaakov and the brothers, right, are all going to be part of the Jewish people, right? Until now, you actually had a chosenness, and then you had people who were not chosen. Here, everyone's going to be chosen. Yaakov is chosen. All his wives have Shvatim. All the kids end up being Shvatim. They, right, chosen, not chosen, they all end up being part of Klal Yisrael. But what's the feeling someone gets if all he ever hears is, you're the chosen one, you're the chosen one, you're the chosen one? Right? How much sympathy do you have for the other? Right? Very little. If you're brought up on privilege, you say, you're the chosen one, they're not. Right? The chance you're going to have empathy for others is low. So once Yaakov hits, and everyone post-Yaakov is going to be part of the Jewish people, the one lesson they have to learn is, what does it feel like to be the non-chosen one? So my friend argued that at some level, that's what the Yaakov story is about. It's that everyone in Yaakov's family needs to go through a non-chosen moment, right? Yaakov goes through it in the brachot, right? And then he has to suffer for it all through the Lavan story. Yosef, who's the chosen one, has to spend 20 years, you know, 22 years as a slave before he gets to be, right, the chosen one again, right? But he has to go through the feeling of not being chosen, of being the slave, of being rejected. The Shvatim, right, have to go through the experience of being the not chosen one. Rachel and Leah, Right? And for those who were here the first week, right, it may be the Rachaleah story is about this, of how they deal with their feelings of feeling like each of them have stolen the place of the other. Each of them have to go through the experience of not being chosen, perhaps to develop the empathy for those who are not chosen. To realize that just because you're chosen doesn't give you privileges and you don't have to care about everybody else. You have to care about them. You have to understand, right, that being chosen isn't just a privilege, it's a responsibility, and you have to express that responsibility by caring about the people who are not chosen or who are less fortunate. If we look at the chiasm in that light, right, that this is, in many ways, let's say, Yaakov's lesson about what it means to be not chosen, slash his education that he made a mistake in hurting Esav, who was the unchosen one, right? We can easily read this chiastic structure as Yaakov's lesson in empathy about chosenness. And now if we look back at the chiasm from that perspective, it starts with Yaakov deceiving Esav, and it finishes with him being victorious in the open. But more importantly, it starts with him causing Yaakov, as we said, to cry, right? Vayisako lo vayefk, and him finishing by saying to him, Ulai Yisafanai, maybe he will forgive me, but with that same language, meaning I want to reverse it. And the linguistic point we pointed out last week is it starts with him taking the bracha, and it finishes with him giving a mincha, right? Giving a gift to Esav, which he calls Kachna et Birchati, take my blessing, right? It's so another way of reading this story is that he goes through the Lavan story, right? Now, if we go to the middle of the chiasm, the middle of the chiasm is Yaakov dealing with deceit, is dealing with, right, the deceit that makes love, right, Leah be the unchosen one and Rachel be the unchosen one, and him, right, being, right, being messed over by love and having to deal with that whole circle that happens in the middle, that whole mess that happens in the middle because people aren't being chosen. And this just begins the story of his children's sort of, you know, complexes. Right? Yaakov has to feel, look what happens, right? Look at the result of being deceived, right? Realize what you did to Esav. Even if you were right, this wasn't the right way of doing it. You're supposed to have sympathy. You're supposed to recognize what you owe to the other, to the one who's not chosen. And it isn't until he's willing to turn to Esav and say, Kachnai berchati, I understand what you did, and I want to change, right? Vayisako lo vayev, you're raising your voice in tears, to ulai yisafanai, to you forgiving me. Right? Only once he recognized what he did was wrong, and that he didn't go about being the chosen one correctly, right, that he has to have empathy for the one who is not chosen, and realize that, right, just because he's chosen doesn't allow him to hurt the other. Only then can he be, right, Yisrael. So if we think that Yaakov did something wrong, right, so then the chiasm takes on a totally different meaning. It starts with him not recognizing that he's tricked Esav out of chosenness and being sort of flippant about it, to him realizing, even though he remains the chosen one, right, that his responsibility to the not chosen one is to, right, is to make amends, is take my bracha. You're not really taking my bracha, I'm still the chosen one, but take my bracha, right? Forgive me, I realize what I did to you. And again, in the middle of the story, that's a lot of what happens also. And right, you can listen to the shir we did the first week, that same thing happens with Rachel and Leah, right? That Rachel and Leah seem to have this constant blaming of each other, but Rachel's switching for Leah is a certain level of recognition that, oh, I realize what you've been through, right? Why don't you, I'm actively saying, you know, go to be with Yaakov without the deception. And we noted then the linguistic parallels that Yaakov works, right? He works for 7 years, and the Lashon is Sachar, right? He's rented for 7 years. And when Leah, for the first time, goes to Yaakov, this time as, right, with Rachel's approval and not through deception, she says to Yaakov, Ki Sachor Secharticha, I've, right, the same language, I've sort of bought you, right? But the linguistic parallel points out again the difference, that it starts off with Yaakov being deceived for his schar, and it ends with an openness where Rachel and Leah are totally open about the switch, and Leah sachor sachartikha. So again, it's a fix of the passive trickery to an open sachor sachartikha. And again, in the middle, like I said, there's more, because it's not just what does Yaakov learn? A lot of the middle stories, what do the Imahot learn about themselves? I can resend out the link if people want to listen to that. But at least from the Yaakov perspective, I think the chiasm works for Yaakov just as well as it does for them. So if we come back to what we said last week, and like I said, right, the Bracha story opens up the rest of Bereishis, right? Is we have this, right, 200 psukim immediately following the Bracha story, which is the story of how Yaakov becomes Israel. And depending on what we think happened in the Bracha story, it's going to strongly affect what we think was supposed to change from point one, right, to the end in Yaakov's, right, return to Israel as Yisrael this time. Right? If you think he did nothing wrong, then the only seeming thing that Yaakov has missed until this point is the ability to be active, to be a doer, to overcome adversity. So this story is about him changing from a passive person who's sent by his parents, who encounters the angels only in dreams, to the person who confronts Esav himself, who sends the Malachim towards him, and who doesn't need to deceive, but can win by strength, who goes from davening to God that so that he will save him and sets up a rock Mizbeach to daven to God, to being the person who says, God has helped me, and now I can forge a nation, I can set up a treaty. He goes from being the passive to being the active, from being the Yaakov Ishtam Yosheva Olim, sort of the naive person who's never been a public personality, to the person hardened by experience, and therefore he's able to take on the same experience, but this time as a subject and not an object. If you think that, no, what Yaakov did is wrong, then we're looking for two things. One is punishment, which we discussed last week, but the other is a process of education, because God doesn't just leave it at punishment. If you did something wrong and you're going to be the leader of the Jewish people, you need to learn what you did wrong. So he needs to go through this experience of what does it feel like to be the one shunted to the side, to be the unchosen one. He has to go through it. Rachel has to go through it. Leah has to go through it. The Shvatim have to go through it so that they learn to have sympathy for the other. And if we read it this way, then it sounds like Yaakov actually learned the lesson, because on the other side, he confronts Esav, and it's actually interesting, right? We tend to think of the story that when he went back, he suddenly realized, oh, Esav is chasing me. But that's not actually what happened, right? If you read the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, right, what happens before he finds out that Esav is chasing him? He sends the Malachim to Esav. So it's true that Esav happens to be chasing him, but he actually asked for it, right? We always get caught up in the fact that, oh, Esav's men were chasing him, Yaakov must be running away. But no, that's not true. Is Yaakov was willing to face him before he knew he was coming to attack him. He sent the Malachim. He's, right, going to Esav, right? He's initiating the encounter as opposed to running away from the encounter because he wants to fix it. So if, in fact, Yaakov had made a mistake and needs to learn the lesson, then this story is the story of him gaining the empathy of the one who is not in the favored position, learning how to deal with it, and then at the end doing tshuva and trying to at least feel what Esav felt and trying to make amends. This continues into the next stories, right? Because even if this is true that Yaakov, at some level, learns his lesson, right? As we sort of alluded to, you would think, okay, great, now the story's over. But it's really only the beginning for Yaakov's children. And at some level, the deception, non-chosenness stories, right, continue to play themselves out in his children's lives. So it seems like even if at some level the story is over for Yaakov, right, now he's passing the baton over to his children, right, not everything has quite been fixed yet. Because now if you just think about the stories that are coming, right, Shimon and Levi is a story of deception, right, for them to, right, save save Dina. And if we just allude to it, but we don't have time to get into the second, right, at some level, it sounds like part of their conversation with Yaakov is a question of chosenness. Is right, and if you follow there the use of the different descriptions of Dina, either our sister or our daughter, right? At the beginning, right, she is called our sister, our sister, our sister. But then when Yaakov says, she's called our daughter, our daughter, our daughter, and Yaakov and the brothers are all calling her daughter, even though they're not. At the end of the story, when Yaakov says, you did the wrong thing, they respond, but she's our sister, right? Which may be their way of saying, right, you don't think she's enough of your daughter because you never liked our mother, right? Right? Right, you're not willing to do it for your daughter, right? At the beginning, we were saying we'd save our daughter, but you weren't willing to save her, so we did something for our sister, right? So one way of reading the Shimon and Levi story is they're grappling with being the children of the unchosen one, feeling like Yaakov doesn't feel like they are children, and therefore they have to stick up for their siblings rather than bitenu, but achotenu, right? The Yosef story and the Shvatim story, even if the Shimon and Levi story isn't that, that's clearly the Yosef story, right, is them feeling that Yosef is the chosen one and begrudging it, and how they come to terms with that. So, again, even if Yaakov at some level comes to resolution, right, the following stories are really the question of how his children grapple through these same issues, right, which takes us to the end of Sefer Bereishis.